Well, historian Santayana tells us those who forget history are doomed to repeat it. There is much in the history of food from which we can learn, and that history leads us to ask, what can bread, beer, and change tell us about our future?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 718th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Drummondville who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Good morning, Michael.
Folks, there is much in the history of food from which we can learn, and that history leads us to ask some very interesting questions, like, why agriculture? Before we humans began cultivating crops some 10,000 years ago, we had successfully fed ourselves by hunting animals and gathering plant matter. And contrary to what one might think, hunters and gatherers in many temperate climates, like the native populations, for example, who roam the great American grasslands, those people probably led a rich, rewarding lives. So why did we put down this relatively easy existence of hunting and gathering for the harsh physical labor of growing crops? Another question, which crops? The history of agriculture is, but for a very short period of time, the history of human toil. It took a tremendous amount of energy to fuel that labor, and the energy had to come from the crops. Which crops had enough energy in them to sustain the tremendous amount of human labor it took to build civilizations? And finally, what can the history of agriculture tell us about our future? Is Santayana right? Can the agricultures of the ancient Sumerians, Egyptians, Chinese, Bantu, and Mayans give us a look into our future? Or has our petroleum-based industrial agriculture freed us forever from the constraints of the past? Here to help us cultivate some answers, we have Thomas and Carol Sinclair, co-authors of Bread, Beer, and the Seeds of Change, Agriculture's Imprint on World History. Well, Sinclairs, welcome to the Food Chain. Do we have you there? Okay, good. Thomas, are you there too?
Yeah.
Okay, I barely hear you, so I'll turn up my headset here. Maybe Nikki can turn him up as well. Husband and wife team, welcome aboard. So which one's the boss?
Depends on where we are. We're in the house, so Carol is now.
Okay, good. That being the case, Carol, will start with you. How on earth did you come to be involved in the writing of this book, Bread, Beer, and the Seeds of Change?
Well, Tom is an agricultural scientist, and he had talked for years about some time in the future writing a book about the importance of agriculture in human history, how it has influenced human history, and perhaps we've lost track of that with our urbanized society. And I got involved in it because we were traveling. We were actually spending time up at Harvard, and I had fantastic library resources available and time to look into it. And I thought, well, I'd do some background research for him, but became so enthusiastic about the ideas that I found that it ended up being the co-project.
Well, good for you. My wife and I work on a lot of projects together, so I know how important it is to have a good teamwork. I think all good writers have a good team in a spouse of some kind, but maybe not. Maybe there's someone that didn't. Thomas, you're a crop scientist?
That's correct.
And what kind of crops did you work with?
I work with a whole range of crops. My interest is in physiology, and particularly how do we make crops more tolerant of drought. So we're digging into some of the basic processes in the different crops and seeing how we can improve them. And right now we're looking at particularly focused on soybean, maize, sorghum, and peanut. So we're covering a lot of territory.
Well, let me ask you both, just at the top of the here of the show. Does Santayana's admonition ring true? If we forget history, are we condemned to repeat it, or has our technology somehow allowed us to become superior to that notion? Thomas?
Yeah, well, people are going to eat, so that's something we have to remember all through, you know, through all activities. And societies around this world are having problems that don't have enough food to eat, particularly in places like Africa. And so that, I think, is always looming out there. Now we avoid the problem, for instance, in industrial countries, because we basically are using oil to do high-yield agriculture. And as the prices creep up, I think that... that can be a warning that the food probably will creep up also, as we're seeing today.
So, Carol, it's fair enough then to think that maybe we should be looking at the history of agriculture with a thought about our future, correct?
Well, I think so. And one of the ideas that interested me was that in our Western civilizations, at least, we've become very divorced from our food supply. And nature is still out there, possibly with some unpleasant events that can occur to mankind and to our food supply. And I think for many of us, we have lost the ability to go back to the soil and support ourselves. Just
yes,
a basic understanding of how to feed ourselves.
Most of us probably are of the opinion that food will always be there because it's always in the supermarket, and so perhaps maybe we should give a thought to this. But let's start with one of the most interesting questions in your book: why agriculture? I've often thought that to me that the apogee of civilization was the Plains Indians after the horse and before the white man. It seemed like what a wonderful existence. You just follow the great buffalo herds and you eat meat and you gather herbs and plant matter and you just keep traveling. Your diet is diverse. Your life is free. Whenever the garbage piles up, you just pick up in your teepee and move to the next nice place. No central government to tax you and turn you into a wage slave. Why did we turn away from hunting and gathering to for the hard toil of growing crops, Thomas?
Well, there's a lot of ideas about that, and things like population spiral and people accumulating things. But that to we both were raised in rural area and kind of appreciate the hard work of this. And that none of those ideas kind of resonate with us. Something had to happen to make people really want to do that. And I think this all started being triggered after last ice age, and all these cereals, wheat and barley, became available. People started to collect these, and by accident, we think they learned to ferment. And the hunter-gatherers historically were pretty well involved in using mood-altering substances. As you suggest, they had, in some ways, an idyllic lifestyle. We use the analogy that it was the Garden of Eden, and the.
Did you say the Garden of Eden, or the Garden?
Eden, E D E N.
Oh, okay. I thought you said Eden.
No. So that the lifestyles you described it was pretty reasonable. I mean, obviously, you don't have any of the modern conveniences, but it was reasonable. Jared Diamond argues that one of the worst things that ever happened to mankind was to give up that lifestyle. So we wondered then what was the trigger point, and we think it was when people started to have this fermented grain and got to like alcohol.
And, Carol, how did that work? So you're saying one of the great transitions in history was keyed by the fact that we like to drink booze.
Yes, I'm afraid that is the fact, and this is not a new idea to us. It's an idea that's been around. Anthropologists have discussed it for a generation at least, and actually made a conscious decision not to teach the alcohol theory of the rise of civilization, because it wasn't a good thing to teach our young people that their ancestors were a bunch of drunks. Now we're coming more to the truthfulness, and therefore we're talking more about the alcohol and its influence.
Well, this is awfully very interesting to me, so we're going to have to take a quick break. But when we come back, I would like to talk with the both of you, Thomas and Carol Sinclair, authors of Bread, Beer, and the Seeds of Change, how alcohol worked, or what our relationship was with alcohol that really keyed this change from being hunters and gatherers to laboring and toiling in the field. What made for that wonderful transition from that idyllic life of in the Garden of Eden to toiling in the field? Folks, this is The Food Chain. Right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, folks, it was the booze that made us do it. We had this wonderful existence, hunting and gathering our way through the Garden of Eden. And then for some reason, by golly, we just put it aside and started digging in the dirt and planting crops and enduring millenniums of hard physical labor to grow crops. Why did we turn away from the Garden of Eden for the hard physical labor of growing crops? The booze made us do it. That's what the Sinclairs say, Thomas and Carol Sinclair, co-authors of Bread, Beer, and the Seeds of Change. Carol, you want to start us off on this? Why exactly did booze make us do it?
Well, I think it is part of the human psyche to seek out mood-altering substances, however they can be found. And there's evidence of fungi that were used by the cavemen. Probably that and early fermented substances were used ritually, probably by the high priests or whatever the hierarchy of the tribe was. And gradually, over a long period of time, its use filtered down to more and more people. And once tasted, that is an experience that mankind seeks to repeat. Archaeologists and anthropologists have actually even studied the evolution of mammals into man. And the earliest mammals were tiny little creatures who lived on leaves. And as they became larger in body size, leaves aren't nutrient-dense enough to support an increased body size. So the theory is that all mammals at some stage in their evolution became fruit eaters, fruit being a more concentrated sugar source. Now, not all fruits are equal in terms of digestibility, calories available, but ripe fruit is always a better food than unripe fruit. And these early fruits, before we tampered with their genetics, may not have signaled by color their ripeness. But as fruit ripens, it begins to ferment. And those creatures who could smell the ethanol, smell the fermenting fruit, would eat that fruit, would get better nutrition, would pass their genes on to more offspring, and it became part of our DNA to seek out alcohol.
You know, I had an opportunity to visit the Shipibo Indians on the headwaters of the Amazon River, and That's what they did. They were hunters and gatherers, and they had wonderful foods, and they loved their libations, some of which was called masato. It's a fermented yucca, mm-hmm. and the other was an ayahuasca blend, which was a psychotropic mixture of herbs. But that was a huge part of their existence, the intoxicants, I guess you might call them. Thomas, how exactly does that translate to food?
What you need is something that ferments well, and if you're trying to have this fermentable product all year round, you need something that you can store and then ferment at will. And as it turns out, these cereal grains are essentially ideal for that. They're high in starch, and if you put them in water, and they tend to start breaking down, releasing sugars, and then yeast from the atmosphere settles in that mixture. And within a couple of days, you can have a mixture that has a bit of alcohol in it. So it's
actually whether you want to or not, right?
That's right. That's right.
It's just going to happen. If you leave your bowl of porridge on the table, it's going to turn into a beer, an alcohol.
That's right. And using that analogy of Garden Eden, what we say, the fruit that they ate really wasn't a fruit. It was probably cereals. And the knowledge that caused the trouble was to learn how to ferment that cereal.
Incredible. So that takes us to the Golden Triangle, Mesopotamia.
Yeah.
And the beginnings of civilization, correct?
That's right. That's the first place where they really started to sow and harvest the material.
So we're talking what, 10,000 years ago?
Well, they started harvesting, and probably individuals sowing started that time. But really the culture where they could put together a whole civilization that with city-states began something like about 5,000 years ago.
Let me ask you about the nutrition of the two ways of going about things. It seems like the hunters and gatherers would have a better nutrient quality to their bodies or physical beings than with the farmers of grains, because the hunters and gatherers, at least when there are enough things to eat, you would have a variety of sources of things to eat. But when you're farming, or when you hunker down in civilization in one place, pretty much the only thing left is what you grow, correct?
Pretty much so. I mean, there would be, you know, still a bit of foraging in the hillsides. The agriculture was in the river valleys. But for the most part, you're correct. They survived on the grains that they grew, and the amount of effort required to grow those grains reduced the time or energy available to look for other food sources. And it's known that the early hunter-gatherers were taller, lived longer, and therefore we can probably assume were healthier than the early agriculturists. So there was a huge sacrifice made in terms of quality and even longevity of life to give up the nomadic existence, to become settled, to become dependent on grains.
And for booze, correct? All for
yes,
booze.
And for the booze. Right. You know, we have to understand, once people started living statically in communities, there would be no clean water source available. Now, people may not have understood the mechanism by which water could make you ill or even kill you, but they saw from their experience what happened. Well, a fermented beverage, even with low alcoholic content, does give some protection. It kills off some of the microbes. So people who drank the fermented beverage, which we call beer, even though you may not have recognized it as a beer when compared to today's beers, had some health protection. And actually, for most of mankind's history, most people drank only two beverages in their entire life, their mother's milk and then fermented beverage, or what we call beer.
Because if you were to drink the city water, as it were, you would probably get sick and die.
That's right, and this continued for a very long time. We're really talking up to World War II before there were reliably safe city water systems.
And I guess, you know, we hear a lot about European cultures where children are taught to drink wine at a very young age. Would that be part of this sanitary situation where you had to drink something that had been fermented to survive?
Probably it began that way so far back that people don't even remember the reason for it, and then it becomes a cultural practice.
And then what led you to look at these ancient cultures? Why did you go back and look at them,
well,
Thomas?
Well, not many people, at least from the agriculture side, really looked at how these cultures developed and how dependent the course of history of these cultures were on their capability of growing crops. And that's what really intrigued me. And of course, we started with Sumeria because that is the first, that is civilization.
Mm-hmm.
And civilization is synonymous with starting agriculture.
So we're going to have to take a quick break here, but when we come back, that's exactly where we want to go. We're going to take a look at the ancient Sumerians some 10,000 years ago in Mesopotamia's Golden Triangle. We'll go to Egypt and the Nile and the Great Nile. And we'll go to China. And then we'll look at the Bantus of Africa and the Mayans of Central America. And we'll look at these cultures and see how agriculture, how it was really agriculture that allowed them to build these wonderful civilizations, and what happened to their agriculture that caused those civilizations to wither and change and go away. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, right back. Do stay tuned. Well, folks, Michael Olson's first law of the food chain, agriculture, is the foundation upon which we'll all our sandcastles. And if you look back into the history of human civilizations, you see that's kind of true. At least that's what I get from reading Bread, Beer, and the Seeds of Change by husband and wife team Thomas and Carol Sinclair. Does it ring true to you, Thomas, agriculture being the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles?
Oh, I wouldn't say sandcastles, but that's what civilizations build on. It started really with the Sumerians along the Euphrates River. And,
what was it about the Mesopotamia area that allowed the Sumerians to build that first civilization?
Well, first they had seeds readily available. So on the hillsides there was a lot of barley and wheat, or ancestors of our current modern barley and wheat. And the Euphrates came from the Taurus Mountain, which is in the north, really a part of it in Turkey, and came through the whole desert. So by the time it got to what's now southern Iraq, it was flowing very slowly, dropped its silt, and it raised its bed. It was pretty high, and which made it easy to cut into the riverbanks and flow water into canals and irrigate the field. And so that's what was really the advantage. They had this fertile area and had the water source that could do it. And, of course, when you have a organizing people to do all these things, then you got into the elements of civilization.
And what happened to Mesopotamia? How long did the civilization last?
Well, it lasted about 1,500 years. It was a long time. But you can imagine what happened, as I described, the river was about the level of the land. And if you keep irrigating, there's salts in that water, and if you don't have any way to flush the salts out, the salts accumulate in the field, and in areas like Southern California, a lot of technology is on how to flush those salts out of the soil. So in Sumeria, the salts build up, and wheat went out of production. It's pretty sensitive to the salt. Barley is less sensitive, and so the Sumerians became especially famous for drinking the beer out of the barley. And but over time, even barley wouldn't grow, and so the Sumerians had to move further north up the river. And eventually they hit some people that weren't very happy about this, and they lost militarily, and that was essentially the collapse of their society. And I could say those salt marshes are still existing. They're in the southern reaches of Iraq. We heard about the insurgencies hiding in the salt marshes. Well, those are the remnants of partially due to the what the Sumerians left.
So it was salt, and that of course is something we still deal with today. The biology and chemistry hasn't changed a bit.
That's right, and as I say, they're dealing with it in Southern California. Egypt has a real problem now because the Nile River they've dammed up, and they just irrigate enough to water the crops, and salt, they're having problems with salt buildup there too.
Well, let's go to Egypt because that's next on your list, and one of my favorites because I had the opportunity to visit Egypt, and you know, the damming of the Nile was a huge incident in Egyptian agriculture, because it was really the source of fertility of the Nile, and when they dammed the Nile, they cut off that flow, and so big changes there. But take us way back into antiquity and talk about the development of the great Egyptian civilization, made possible of course by the Nile. But it was also made possible by the desert, was it not? Because the desert shielded that civilization from the outside?
Well, to some extent, that's true. I mean, the Egyptians, in some ways, are some of the luckiest people, at least at that time in history, because they had this river that was fed by the rains in Central Africa during the summer, and the floods of the Nile reached the Egyptian area in late August through September, and then receded in October. October is exactly the time you'd want to plant the crops, the wheat and barley, and so that the Nile had fully filled the soil with water. They'd left some nutrients, and they'd washed away the weeds. So here you had the perfect circumstance. You grew the crops through the winter, harvested into at about March, and then you could sit around until the Nile flooded again. And this led to what do you do with all these people?
We've talked a lot about how agriculture demanded that hunter-gatherers give up many things, but we really haven't talked about the other side of the picture. And we have gifts that came to us through agriculture, in addition to the food and the alcohol. Hunter-gatherers had no need to learn to write. They had no need for mathematics.
Right.
Once you started organizing societies around agriculture, you had to keep track of crops and what belonged to whom and what did the government get, and that led to these human advances. And then in Egypt particularly, when the Nile gave them the gift of these monks of freedom from agricultural work, the organized society, the pharaohs, were able to call on a huge workforce to build their monuments, to build the pyramids.
Carol, I took that one step further. When I was in Egypt, we were as guests of an environmental organization that was also hosting a bunch of Egyptologists, and we were having lunch right underneath the Great Pyramid of Cheops at the Mina House, and they were discussing all of the reasons for this pyramids and whatnot, and I just piped up as an agriculturist. I thought that the pharaohs had no choice but to build those pyramids, because imagine, you know, being a pharaoh in charge of and having at your feet all of these this incredible population of these well-fed, energetic people. Boy, you better start doing something with them, right? I mean, you better put them to work, or you're going to be in big trouble really quickly. So, hey, go over there and get those rocks and bring them up here and stack them up, you know?
Yeah.
But they had this incredible population of well-fed, energetic people made possible by the flow of the Nile. And there was the nutrients that came down the Nile. I love the description that you gave of the nutrients from the Blue Nile and the nutrients from the White Nile, and how that made the perfect nutrient soup to enrich the soil. Could you give a quick on that, Thomas?
Well, the the one leg of it comes from the highlands of Ethiopia, basically, and it's just the roads, the area there. There isn't much. It's dry during the summer, so there isn't much vegetation. And so this is your source of the rock nutrients of potassium and phosphorus.
And the white Nile?
Yes, I think. And then the other leg comes from Central Africa, which is essentially
marshes,
you know, swamps. So I guess that's
decaying plant. So you get the decaying plant matter, which makes all the nitrogen,
exactly.
Nitrogen, phosphorus,
so
and potassium.
When you get the summer rains.
We're going to have to take a quick break, Thomas. We're going to have to take a quick break. Right back, folks. We'll take you to China. Do stay tuned. We're back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're in ancient Egypt, going into modern Egypt. And we're wondering, what on earth happened when they dammed the Nile and turned off the flow of nutrients? We're asking Thomas and Carol Sinclair, authors of Bread, Beer, and The Seeds of Change. Thomas, what happened when they no longer were able to, when the Nile no longer flooded the plains and enriched the soil?
Well, it could greatly expand the area that they could put under agriculture because they used all the water, and it wasn't, mm-hmm. A lot of the water would flow out into the Mediterranean Sea. Basically, little does that now, so they greatly expanded the area that they could grow crops, but of course they had to supply the fertility, so this required bringing
are
in
they?
modern fertilizers.
Are they able to supply the fertility?
Yes, they can use modern fertilizers to do that. The problem they're struggling with now is, as I described earlier, they aren't flushing the soil, so they're having some salinity problems. The salt's building up, and that's really what they've got to work on. And this means probably heavier irrigation, so you flush the soil, and then that downside is you probably can't support all the acres they now have in production. So they're really in a difficult situation.
Kind of like the same thing that happened in Mesopotamia.
The salt is an issue every place that you irrigate. It's a real challenge.
Well, a less friendly river, of course, is the Yellow River in China. Why was it not so friendly, Carol?
Well, it caused a lot of destruction of the structures that humans tried to put up. It was not controlled to mankind's benefit as the Nile had been. So the Chinese people saw the river as a kind of enemy that would bring the disastrous flash flood.
And of course, when they say disastrous in China, that means a lot of people lost their lives and their living,
right.
Too.
It always means a lot of people in China.
The Nile, of course, brought a lot of nutrients to enrich the fertility of the soil, but not so much the Yellow River. Why not?
Well, the Yellow River originates in the highlands to the... we're talking about northern China now, it originates to the west, and it's dry. And so, as a result, the plant life is very sparse in this area. The soils are what we call a lush soil. It's wind-blown. They've been blown in over the eons, and there you have this fairly loose soil with little vegetation on it. So when it rained, when they finally get a rain sometime, it would all just wash out into the river and then have this surge downstream flooding it. And because you had all this silt, then the river itself was high relative to the plain, so it easily broke its bank and flooded the whole countryside.
Why did civilization start in northern China instead of southern China?
Well, the difficulty is that the southern area was had the river that also flooded, but it was surrounded by all the marshland, and they didn't have the ability really to
control
to drain it and really have the highly productive system. In the north, they could grow millets and wheat, which were native there, and this was the basis for their civilization, and soybean, I should say, the basis of their civilization.
The most interesting thing happened to decompose the Chinese civilization that was built on that agriculture, in that its success led to its failure. Carol, how did that work?
Well, let me answer that. That's the area I worked on a bit. It's the peasants were what was used to grow all these things, and if the emperors taxed appropriately, the peasants were quite happy. But eventually, the Han Dynasty is what we talked about. After about 400 years, they got some emperors that really put heavy taxes on, and the peasants.
So the reason, they needed more taxes was because they kept adding to the civilization of the cities, right? They kept adding more bureaucrats to the court, and so to pay for all of this added weight of government, they had to keep increasing the taxes to the peasants who were producing things.
Yes, yeah.
That's right, and the emperors of China also made some unwise choices. When we talked about the Egyptian pharaohs taking the farmers from the land during the period of time when they had no agricultural work that needed to be done. With the building, particularly of the Great Wall of China, the emperor was taking peasants out of the fields during the time that they needed to be there to produce crops. So he was giving up food to build this fortification, the Great Wall of China, for protection.
And
people
thus
went hungry. People began to starve and no longer supported the emperor.
And so what happened to the Han Dynasty, Thomas?
Well, it eventually collapsed into a civil war. This is about 200 years BCE. And so there's been a succession of dynasties that took control of that. But that dynasty was the origin of the consolidated area, which we call China.
Well, we have a few minutes left, so I guess we're not going to get to the Bantus, which are very interesting, and the Mayans, of course. But the big question is, what can we learn from what we've been through before and all of these, the collapse of these agricultural civilizations? Can we draw anything out of it in order to look into our future? We will be right back. Do stay tuned. Well, folks, what can we learn from the explosive growth and eventual collapse of the great civilizations made possible by clever agriculture? The Sumerians, the Egyptians, the Chinese, the Bantu, the Mayans. There must be some lessons. Well, one of the more interesting lessons I picked up from Bread, Beer, and the Seeds of Change by Thomas and Carol Sinclair was the need to maintain a balance between foods that you get from elsewhere and foods that you produce locally. Carol, would you like to elaborate on that lesson a little bit for us?
The modern society has given us opportunities to sample foods from around the world, and this has improved nutrition. It's made vitamins available in the wintertime that would never have been possible in previous times. It's also created a disconnect between ourselves and our food supply. My children don't know when asparagus is in season or what time of year local strawberries would be available unless we dragged them out to a pick-your-own place and gave them that experience of seeing the food growing in the field. And many of our children don't ever get that opportunity. Milk comes from the supermarket, and it's a little bit scary sometimes when they discover where milk really comes from. So I think this is something that probably in the family that we need to deal with as parents to make our children aware of the food.
Good enough. And Thomas, we've been living on bread and beer, at least those of us who toil in the fields for millenniums now. What do you see the future here is of fermenting grains? Where are we going to take this?
Well, I have some concerns about this because we don't get these grains without committing our resources, particularly soil and water and nutrients. And so any grain you get out there, it's not free. It takes tremendous amount of resources and effort by farmers to grow it. And I think we have to use this resources wisely and the crops we get from them. And quite frankly, when I've done the analysis of this biofuel issue, this is not as far as I can see, not a way that we want to commit our resources. It impacts so much on the resource needs that doesn't seem viable in terms of, again, fermentation to get the ethanol, but in this case, feed machines.
So the numbers, you just don't see the numbers adding up?
No, not in terms of what's required to grow the crops. Now, others are worried about whether you even get a positive energy return. It seems you do, but it's not a huge one. But what worries me is what the ancient civilizations taught us is that you had to protect your resource, had to conserve the resources, the soil and the water and fertility.
And if you don't?
Beg your pardon?
If you don't husband your resources, what happens?
Well, the collapse of societies are there without the food. Now, I think U.S. is insulated from that because of the huge resource we have, but on a global scale, I think it would be really devastating.
Well, Thomas and Carol Sinclair, authors of Bread, Beer, and the Seeds of Change, thank you so much for joining us. I enjoyed your work, and I hope others do as well. It's a great way of looking back to see into our future. Folks, this has been The Food Chain. Join us on the forums at metrofarm.com. Leave your comments in there. Thank you very much for tuning in.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.